digital is the combination of the...
Yeah, so I feel that I have to apologize for speaking at the workshop which I'm co-organizing. But as you have already heard, we had to actually apply some gentle pressure or do some gentle convincing to get some people to talk. So after consulting with the other organizers, we thought that this might fit into the theme. And since my collaborator, Katharina Stroppe, can't be here, I'm talking about this. And what I want to tell has something to do with kind of integrable system, but there's also an ultra-discrete flavor to it. And what I think is the new aspect is that you can describe certain rings which have received a lot of attention in the literature, namely the quantum cohomology ring of the complex Grassmannian and the fusion ring of the SLN or SUN Vesuvio-Novikov-Witten model, can be described as quantum integral models. So let me start out by introducing the rings which I'm going to talk about. So these are algebraic structures. And rather than it would take quite a long time to set up their to set up the geometric setting of the quantum cohomology ring because it's quite a complicated object. So instead, I introduce this ring through a ring isomorphism, and I realize it as a quotient ring in the ring of symmetric functions. So lambda is simply the z-span of the elementary symmetric polynomials in k variables. So here are the elementary symmetric polynomials. That's one of the z-bases. And then we simply allow for coefficients which are integers times some powers in Q. So that's only what that means. And we divide out a special ideal, so a two-sided ideal which is generated by these relations. So what this is saying is that I set the complete symmetric functions, which I've written down here, that I set these to zero, so this bunch, and the last one, n plus k, is basically up to a minus sign equal to the deformation parameter q. So this deformation parameter justifies the quantum in the terminology. And notice that the differences between the elementary and complete symmetric, if you're not familiar with them, that these are square-free monomials, a sum of square-free monomials, where here the indices can be the same. Right. So the ring structure is then introduced by simply adding equivalence classes. Oops, sorry. By adding equivalence classes in this quotient ring and introducing the following product. So I take two Schur functions, which are given by in terms of determinants of the H's or the ERs. And if I multiply these two Schur functions, I get an expansion into these equivalence classes with respect to this quotient times some structure constants. And these structure constants, that's why this ring is so nice and has received much attention. They are positive integers which have an algebra of geometric meaning. First, I probably should say that all the partitions which occur as labels of the Schur functions lie in a bounding box which has height k and width n. So let me say a bit more about the structure constants. Sorry.
There's a grading. About the grading.
The degree D comes on the next slide, if you're asking about that. So the structure constants of the ring, as I said, have an algebra geometric interpretation. Namely, they are the famous Gromov-Witten invariants, and the objects in the quantum cohomology of the Grassmannian, which is basically the set of k planes in the space Cn plus k, are given by certain Schubert varieties. And these Schubert varieties I have denoted by omega lambda, omega mu, and omega mu star up there. And these integers basically count the rational curves of degree d. So the degree is written down here in terms of the number of boxes in each of the Young diagrams. They basically count the number of rational curves of this degree which intersect these three Schubert varieties. And the star is the Poincaré dual. It's basically you take the complement of the partition in the bounding box. So this is called quantum cohomology because it's a deformation of the ordinary cohomology ring, which you recover when you set Q goes to zero. And then you recover basically a well-known expansion of a product of two Schur functions, namely these Gromov-Witten invariants become the Littlewood Richardson coefficients, which have a purely combinatorial meaning. And the quotient, so remember that we had a quotient condition up here. So if you set Q equals to zero, it simply means that you're now setting these H's all to zero. This quotient condition basically just says that the Schur functions, which are that the Schur functions for the partitions, which are outside this bounding box, vanish. So this sum really truncates. Now, if you would set Q equals to 1, you get what is known as the UN Verlinde algebra from the Wessel-Minkowski-Witten ring. So that's a conformal field theory. Maybe I say something about the end of this. This is just to make connection with the literature. So the story and this close relationship between the quantum cohomology ring and fusion rings in conformal field theory goes back to Doan Gapner. And many people have worked on this, so there were works by Waffer, Witten, and there's also the PhD thesis of Agnihotri. And because U of n, the fusion ring of U of n is you have this decomposition of the Lie algebra U of n into SUn and U1, there's an intimate relationship also with the fusion ring which has this Lie algebraic structure, and that's what I'm going to talk about next. So I'm introducing another ring, and this ring again I'll introduce as a quotient ring in the ring of symmetric functions. But this time the ideal which I factor out is slightly different. So before I had here deformation parameter, now I basically ask that this deformation parameter is equal to the k-th elementary symmetric polynomial. And what this is doing in a sense is it's basically you are dividing out this thing here. Right, so as I said, this ring occurs in the context of conformal field theory, but again, we want to simply introduce it or here in the context of a quotient ring of the symmetric function. So I define a product of two Schur functions. I have an expansion in terms of equivalence classes with respect to this quotient, and these are again positive integers, but now the integers which occur have a different meaning, and also the partitions over which I sum are different, so n has been lowered by 1. So there are less elements in the fusion ring than in the quantum cohomology ring. And the geometric interpretation, I think the general case was proven by Foltings. The SLN case has been done by other people before. Now, these integers have the meaning of dimensions of moduli spaces of generalized theta functions. So again, you have a very nice algebraic geometric interpretation of this ring, and that's why it's interesting for mathematicians, because if you can unravel the structure of these rings, you get relationships between the structure constants, certain symmetries, which then tell you about relations between dimensions of moduli spaces of generalized theta functions. Now, what is very unpleasant about these quotient rings is that you have to implement, in a sense, this quotient condition in a way. And even though, by looking at the quotient here, even though it seems to be like only a small change, it's not clear by writing down these quotient realizations how to relate these two rings directly if you write down a product. Especially, you have to always take the quotients, so you have to work with equivalence classes. So this expansion is, for practical reasons, not very, very suitable.
It's not homogeneous ideal now, right? Is it correct? Not homogeneous ideal.
Yes. So the Q has been replaced by this elementary symmetric polynomial.
Yeah, but degree is different, right? Hn plus k, k.
Yes, degrees. They have different degrees, yes.
Is the dimension the same as the number of partitions inside this rectangle?
Yes, yes. So so they are given in terms of binomial coefficients. Now, so what I really think is the new thing here is that you can use integrable systems to describe these two rings in a very simplified fashion. And many of the complicated results which already exist in the literature can be derived now in a much simpler way and can also be generalized. So integrability, for instance, will give you a simple proof that these products which I have defined are associative. Usually these proofs are quite complicated and use sophisticated mathematical machinery. Here we will see that we can bring it down to very simple linear algebra problems. The beta ansatz will occur because I will reformulate this as a quantum integral model of these rings. And the beta ansatz then gives you ring isomorphism, so these quotient rings, which I showed you in the ring of symmetric functions, they actually can be derived from the beta ansatz. And you get explicit expressions for the structure constants, which had this algebraic geometric meaning. So in the quantum cohomology ring there, you can derive easily the Bertrand-Waffer-Intrigue formula. And in the setting of the fusion ring, you derive the Berlinde formula. What I will do is I basically, on the next slides, I define particle creation and annihilation operators, which somehow set up the ring. And this will also lead to new identities, which so far are not in the literature. And as I said, there will be generalizations and deformations of the rings, which I'm talking about, which come out of this formalism. But this is work in preparation. So let me start with the quantum cohomology ring. So what I'm doing is I'm introducing fermion operators, which are basically up to a sign maps from the set of Young diagrams to a set of other Young diagrams where k is increased and n is lowered. And because k is increased and n is lowered, I would like to see k as the number of particles and n as the number of holes. And if I define this map simply by adding a certain boundary rim, so here's an example. So if n and k is equal to 4, and I take this partition in the bounding box 4 by 4, my fermion operator with the label 3 is basically adding a top row of four boxes, this is this one here, and then I subtract, because I have to lower n, so n is the width and k is the height, and then I subtract a boundary rim which starts at a specific point, which is given by the diagonal minus 2 in this case. And you can see more easily what's going on if you basically translate these partitions into 0-1 words. So whenever I go one box to the right, I write down 0, and if I go up, I write down a 1. So this path which I get is basically translated into a 0-1 word, like here. So what C3 star is really doing, it's basically flipping a 0 into a 1. And then you can convince yourself what you add up is this new partition, which you get by subtracting this boundary rim, as I explained earlier. So using this bijection, I have basically now particle creation and annihilation operators acting on it, because I can also define, in a similar way, destruction operators which flip a one letter into a zero. And of course, if they are fermions, so you can't do the same thing twice. So if you apply a destruction operator on a zero, you get zero, and if you apply a creation operator on a one, you get zero as well. And these maps can be lifted to operators over a space. So I fix the total number of sides, if you wish, so the total number of particles and holes, which I can have the maximum number in my system, and I sum now over the Hilbert spaces, which I get by simply looking at the complex linear span of my Young diagrams. And this is what I call the Fermi space. And then you introduce certain hopping operators, which shift basically the particles. So what I envision now is a circle, and the circle is the same as the linear diagram of SL or SUN plus k. So I have something like like this, which is closed, so it's affine at UN. And so this should be SUN plus K. So Dinkin diagram. And I think of each node in this Dinkin diagram as a site in a physical lattice where I can put a fermion. So, and now I introduce these operators, UI, and what they basically do is they just place a fermion. It hops basically on a neighboring site because I'm destroying one and then I'm creating a new one on the next site. And this one is basically where I go to the affine node of my affine Dinkin diagram when the circle closes. And I'm using quasi-periodic boundary conditions, and capital N is the number of particles in my system. And what you can show is that these operators over my Fermi space, that they yield the representation of the affine Neel-Tambelli-Lieb algebra. So this is basically the crystal limit of the usual affine Tambelli-Lieb algebra. It obeys these relations, which you can easily satisfy because you know that these are fermionic operators.
So is I from 1 to n minus 1, instead of n plus k minus
1? No, I is basically going from, is in n plus k.
Yeah, but
yes. Yeah. So that's n plus k minus 1. Yes, thank you. So this is a mistake, yes. And also here, it should be n plus k. Sorry about that. And having this affine Neel-Tambelli-Lieb algebra, I can make work, contact with the work of Postnikov, who wrote down a combinatorial description of the quantum cohomology ring, and we will parallel this construction in terms of the fusion ring. What Postnikov did, he has introduced certain non-commutative symmetric polynomials, which mimic the symmetric versions, so they're elementary symmetric polynomials, in terms of these generators UI of the affine Tambelli-Lieb algebra and complete symmetric ones. And so all the elements in the set I are distinct, and I have to use now a certain ordering because I have non-commuting operators. But the ordering which I use is cyclic. So I give you an example. So for E2, for instance, the anti-clockwise ordering means that always letters with a higher index come first until you hit the last one. So in this case, it's a mistake. It's n plus k is equal to 4. Sorry about this. So if you come to n plus k equals to 4, that's the end of your letters, you basically come to the affine node, then you reverse the order. So 1 becomes before 4. So 1 is bigger than 4 in a sense. That's the cyclic ordering. But then you have 3, 2, 4, 2, 4, 3, and so on in the usual way. And if you use the other order, so clockwise ordering, that's when you get the complete symmetric polynomial. Now, squares and higher powers are absent simply because of the relations of the affine Neel-Tambelli-Lieb algebra, because squares are equal to 0. That's why you don't see higher powers.
One of those terms that Rami ran, Christian.
Did I miss one? Sorry.
4, 2.
So 1, 2, 3... Oh yes, that should be 2, 4, so I missed that one, yes. And the important theorem which we will see an analog of for the fusion ring, which will then be a new result, this one is due to Postnikov, is that, first of all, you can show that these elementary symmetric polynomials in these non-commutative variables commute pairwise, and you recover the ring structure, so the Gromov-Witten invariance, the structure constants, by introducing non-commutative Schur functions through the well-known Jacobi-Churi formula, and then you take the matrix elements. So basically what you do is you act with this operator, so this is a verb in these UIs which consists of these fermion operators. You act on a partition, you get a new partition, and you look which partition it is. And if this is non-zero, what I'm saying is it's equal to the Gromov-Witten invariant, or what Postnikov is saying, I should rather say. Right, and the proof of the theorem is quite involved, and it becomes much simpler if you use the language of integrable systems, and I will demonstrate this for the fusion ring. So, I now basically, after discussing fermions, I now do something similar in terms of bosons, but now I really mean N here, so I'm taking a smaller SUN Dinkin diagram, so only the one with the little n here. And the operators which I introduce are now much simpler, so I don't do, I'm not ending or deleting boundary rims, but I phi j star is going from this set of Young diagrams into this set, so I'm only increasing k now, by adding a column of phi j. That's all what it does. So that's now my particle creation process, and my particle destruction process is taking a column of j boxes away, if that's possible. If it's not possible, it's mapped to zero. And similar as before, I introduce a Hilbert space, so that's my quantum state space, which is simply the linear span of my Young diagrams. And as you can see, I have now an infinite dimensional space because I'm summing, because I'm not having fermions anymore, I can put as many bosons into my system, if you like, as I wish. So that's why this is now an infinite dimensional space. Oops. Right, and this is now really a quantum integrable model in a sense of what we are familiar with from statistical mechanics models also. Namely, you have a solution to the Young-Baxter equation, which is given in terms of these creation and annihilation operators which act on my partitions. So I introduce this Lax operator, if you wish. And this is a 2x2 matrix. So this R matrix acts on C2 times C2, so I can write it as a 4x4 matrix, and this then yields the solution to the Young-Baxter equation. I simply do the usual thing with one does in quantum integrable systems. I introduce the monodimer matrix and decompose this monodimer matrix, which is this product of L operators, in over the two-dimensional space, and this is basically the generators of my Young-Baxter algebra. So A, B, C, and D are the usual objects of which you are familiar with from quantum integrable systems. And then, again, one follows the trodden path one in integrable systems. I introduce this transfer matrix. I introduce also deformation parameter Z and a bunch of Hamiltonians. And the lowest or the most interesting one, which you would consider to be the Hamiltonian describing the system, and the other ones you would consider as integrals of motion, is simply something which makes particle hops to the left and to the right, and the Z enters as a quasi-periodicity parameter. And this integrable model was introduced first by Gopal-Yurup, Vergen, and Kitanin. What is new here is the connection with the fusion ring. So, let me tell you a bit about the Young-Baxter algebra. So the Young-Baxter algebra, the monodimer matrix, should also satisfy the Young-Baxter equation. And there's actually quite a nice combinatorial action of these generators. Let me introduce these partitions, lambda hat, which are basically constructed from the original partition by simply adding k in everywhere in each part and subtracting lambda 1. Then what you find is that the multiple action of your Young-Baxter algebra, so these are the entries of the monodimer matrix, which I showed you on the previous slide, is given as a sum over skew Schur functions, like here. So while it was obvious maybe from the L operator that the monodimer matrix also has to satisfy the Young-Baxter equation, it is not quite obvious from these relations. But you already see that naturally Schur functions come in, and that's what we basically will use in order to make contact with this ring. Now I do the same thing as I did before with the quantum cohomology ring. I introduce left and right hopping operators, or in this case, I'm sorry, only I think they're hopping clockwise. Namely, I take a creation and annihilation operators and bunch them together. And again, when I come to the end of the lattice, I introduce a quasi-periodicity parameter. So Z plays the same role as the Q as an independent cohomology ring. And the claim is that in this case, you now don't get the Neil affine Temple Lieb algebra, but you get a different algebra, which is also known. It is what I call the local affine Plaktik algebra, because these relations, which now look more complicated than in the other case, they specialize if you go to the finite set A1 to AN-1, to the well-known plactic algebra, which occurs in the context of the Robinson-Schanstedt-Knuth correspondence. So there's a nice combinatorial connection. And indeed, so this is where the contact with crystals come in. You can look at the at your state space, which is given by You can look at the state space, which is given by partitions, and I bunch them together with powers in my cross-periodicity parameter Z. And I consider this set, so this is basically the set of elements which generates my state space for fixed particle number k. So I keep k fixed. And if I connect two elements in this set, whenever they are related by these operators AI, so by a clockwise hop. And if I then look at this graph, at this colored graph, which I get in this manner, the statement is that this graph is the same as the crystal graph of the fully symmetric component in this UQSLN module. So in a way, your state space crystallizes. The other important fact in order to make now contact with what I told you before in the kind of cohomology ring is that the transfer matrix, which I introduced earlier, which was given as a sum of two elements in the Young-Baxter algebra, can now be expressed as a polynomial in the A's, so in your clockwise hopping operators on your Dynkin diagram. So here they are the elementary symmetric polynomials which have the same form as in the Kanon cohomology ring, just that the generators obey different relations. So in a way, you can write it in this way, that the transfer matrix is the generating function for these elementary symmetric polynomials in the non-commutative alphabet A. And what I didn't show you is Postnikov's proof, how he showed that the elementary symmetric polynomials commute. In our case, it's a direct consequence of the Young-Baxter equation, because the Young-Baxter equation ensures that the transfer matrices commute. That's a standard argument, which we saw already earlier in the conference. And using this, you can, of course, then, and this identity, it immediately follows that these elementary symmetric polynomials have to commute pairwise. Now, having a generating function for the elementary symmetric polynomials, I also want to have a generating function for the complete symmetric polynomials. And it turns out that this generating function is actually Baxter's Q operator. I will not go into detail, but maybe if I have enough time at the end, I can say something more. But I'm running out of time quite quickly, so maybe this is left for private discussions. So what I wanted to say, actually, is that I want to draw you to attention that now the complete symmetric polynomials look quite different from the Kanon cohomology case, because you get now higher powers because the algebra is more complicated. Now, also non-commutative true functions appear naturally, because if you look at the products of these Q operators and the transfer matrix, what you get are analogs of Cauchy identities. These are well-known identities in the context of the commutative ring of symmetric functions. They introduce here non-commutative symmetric functions, non-commutative symmetric true polynomials, which again turn out to be defined through the Jacobi-Trude formula. So this is well defined, because I showed previously, because of integrability, that all these commutes, the determinant is defined in the usual way. So the ordering doesn't matter. So in particular, even though the generators A do not commute, the true polynomials do commute, so they form a commutative subalgebra. And the main result is now that these non-commutative true functions define a ring. So I do this in the same way as in the Kanon cohomology ring. I act with this non-commutative true function onto a partition and say this should be my product between two elements in the set of Young diagrams. So I take the ring, which is generated by the free abelian group with respect to addition over the integers, and then introduce this product. And the statement is that this product And the ring which I get through this product is the same as the fusion ring. So similar as before, the matrix elements of my non-commutative Schur functions give me these algebraic geometric constants, the dimension of moduli spaces of generalized theta functions, the fusion coefficients as they are known in this literature. And what you can show, or how you prove this identity, is by showing that this thing really gives you the famous Verlinde formula. Ignore the hats. So here I basically use affine waves, but so just ignore the hats. So there's a celebrated Verlinde formula where S is the modular S matrix, which comes from modular transformations of affine characters of Kac-Moody algebras. Right, and what I said in the beginning is that the two rings are very closely related, and what you want to do now is you want to make this as explicit as possible. And as I said in the beginning, the the quotient rings don't really allow you to do this. So numerically, I started out for different reasons to check what the matrix elements were, and I found by looking at the computer first experimentally this relationship. But you can prove this, and the proof is brute force. You simply take the Bertram-Waffer intrilligator formula and the Verlinde formula and use level rank duality in order to show this identity. And this gives you now a concrete relation of Gromov-Witten invariance, which is the number of rational recursive degree d, which intersect certain Schubert varieties, and dimension of moduli spaces of generalized theta functions. And this omega here is the Dünken diagram automorphism, which simply rotates the nodes in your affine Dünken diagram. So it's like a rotation of your Dünken diagram. And this relationship now allows you, and I probably should say that I put a question mark here because we are not quite sure that nobody else has basically derived this. I mean, there's a vast amount of literature. We have certainly looked through much of it, and so far we haven't been able to find this relation. So at the moment, we still believe that this is a new result. But if somebody knows of somebody who has derived this earlier, please let me know. So I'll give you now a flavor of this reduction, or how you relate these two products, because it's quite intriguing. It's because it's an identity between different geometric algebraic geometric objects, right? I mean, here you have rational recursive degree d, here you have the dimension of moduli spaces of generalized theta functions. So here's a concrete example. I hope you can see this, otherwise I switch on the lights. Better. So here's the product of the quantum cohomology ring. So you simply have to believe me that this is correct. So you multiply these two Young diagrams, and this is what you get. And what I want to describe now is how you do the reduction procedure to get the fusion ring multiplication. So first of all, this is basically what I had here. You reduce the Young diagram, so you delete all columns which have height n. So in this case, n is equals to 4, so I would basically delete this column, which leaves me then with this Young diagram. And then in order to basically go from this product, what I have to do, according to the formula, is I have to apply the Dünken diagram automorphism to the power d. So here, the power d is 1 because q occurs to the power 1. What the Dünken diagram automorphism does, it's basically adding a top row of length k. It basically would add to this diagram a top row of length k. But then I have to delete again all the columns which have height 4. So maybe I do this for the first example. So first of all, I have to reduce this one, so this thing goes away. So what I'm left with is 3. Then the identity says I should apply the Dünken diagram automorphism, which is adding a top row of 3 boxes, which leaves me again with a column of 4 boxes. So this I delete, and I end up with a Young diagram which has only 2 boxes. So this is a very simple combinatorial way now, when you have computed basically the quantum cohomology product, how you can relate these expansions. you can work it out now yourself, so at least this is an exercise that all these diagrams can be obtained via this procedure. So the last one is easiest to see, where you have the empty partition here. You simply apply twice the Dinger diagram out of position, meaning you're adding twice a row of three boxes. So in light of this very simple relationship, which you can write down, what you ask yourself is, given these two different combinatorial construction, one in the terms of the Neil affine Tempel-Lieb algebra and one in terms of the local affine Plaktik algebra. So I write this now down in terms of these non-commutative Schur functions. So their products now really expand without taking any quotients. That's a nice thing about it. In a sense, the quotient is built in the relation of the of these algebras, of in the relations which the U's and the A's occur. This basically has removed the quotients. What you ask yourself is now, because of this identity, is there a direct combinatorial proof of this identity? Because this identity, as I said, uses level rank duality, and I would like to get rid of this, because I would think it's nicer to simply use the combinatorial approach to show that this actually holds. And I think that one would gain some insight from this. And particularly note that this is not a simple relationship, because fermion operators, so the U's, are defined on a much larger lattice than the A's. So space is also different in a sense. So the lattices are quite different. Yes, so these are my closing remarks. So part of the results which I have presented, so at the moment we are still writing things up, but part of the results which I have talked about here have appeared in an Oberwolfach report at this conference where Katharina gave the talk. In preparation is a Q deformation of the fusion ring. So you can actually write down a kind of integrable model which uses another deformation and set up a new ring structure. And we hope that we will be able to make contact with interesting algebraic constructions. And the other open problem, which is also in preparation, is to extend this point of view to fusion rings which are not only related to SUN, but to arbitrary algebras. And with that, I'm at the end of my talk, and I close a bit early, but that's fine, since this is the last talk, people might be tired.
So are there questions, comments, or whispers?
These ENH in terms of U,
yes.
Rather strange, because they coincide when things commute.
Yes.
So, is there any significance to that? I mean, why?
It's basically the algebra is to blame. So in a sense, the structure collides if you make things commutative. It must have something to do with the particular nature of the quotient which you take in the Kernighan cohomology ring. So the structure in the Kernighan cohomology ring is much simpler. So the affine Neil Tempel-Lieb algebra is a much simpler algebra than the affine Plaktik algebra. So at the moment I can't give any deeper insight than that. It has something to do of finding out what the relation is also between the two rings, between these two algebras. But yes, it is.
I mean, is anything to do with the fact that in this reduction you need to concentrate on symmetric Young diagrams, for example? That would be one situation in which E and H would...
What do you mean by symmetric Young diagrams?
I mean self-transpose.
No, that wouldn't occur. So I think it's rather in the nature of the quotient condition which you impose on your ring.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned this geometric interpretation of this coefficient.
Yes.
Does it help to compute? What's the best way to compute these numbers? I mean, what is
so
the situation?
Yeah. So these are the identities which I didn't want to present yet. So there are algorithms. So you can use the Bertram-Waffer intrilligator formula and the Verlinden formula, and that's what I did basically. So I implemented those on Mathematica to, for example, calculate this example. But very quickly this becomes very cumbersome, even for the computer, if the rank increases. Now, for the kernel cohomology ring, there exists a known Rimhook algorithm by Bertram Fulton and somebody else whose name I can't remember. There you add certain n-rims, and you get recurrence relation, and that's how you can build up. So this would be the efficient way to calculate it there. For the fusion ring, there's the Katz-Walton algorithm, which uses the affine Weyl group. But again, these algorithms, so especially the Katz-Walton algorithm, runs into problems as soon as the Weyl group becomes quite large. Now, the beauty of this approach, I think, is that you have particle creation and relation operators. So what this does, it will relate smaller fusion rings with larger ones, and smaller kernel cohomology rings with larger ones. So for the kernel cohomology ring, we have already a recursion formula, which basically links Gromov-Witten invariants of the Grassmannian. So if I take the Grassmannian of k planes in the space n, we can already write things down which relate Gromov-Witten invariants with let's say k minus 1 n. Because you can simply now create and destroy particles, and that gives you, because you have this matrix element interpretation, that gives you new algorithms. And something similar also exists for the fusion rings. But since it's not written up, I didn't present it here. But that's what I meant in the middle of my talk, that this formalism is quite fruitful. It makes things very simple. One can now explain to a physics undergraduate what the kernel cohomology ring is, because they all know what free fermions are. And it makes computations very easy. Also, symmetries of Gromov-Witten invariants and the known symmetries of fusion coefficients are very easily derived with this formalism. So integrable systems are really very helpful in this context.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank Christian.
So maybe we basically just wanted to say thank you to the audience for coming to Glasgow and for the talks which you have given. We enjoyed this very much. I learned a lot. Please, Claire, come to the front as well. And I just want to draw to your attention that this is not really the end. So this workshop might be followed up by a workshop in Tokyo, which is part of the Prime Minister's initiative. We have a grant which finances the exchange, and we hope that in 2010 a workshop will take place subject to finance. So maybe Ralph Willox or Tukihiro-san can say something more. So they will be in charge of this meeting, so watch for an announcement from them. And we hope that it will be in a similar theme, and that as many interesting talks will take place as during this conference. And finally, if we could convince you of Scottish hospitality at least a little bit, we hope to see you probably again in 2011, when Island 4 is due to take place, where we will be in a different setting probably on Isla again.
Yes, I think probably on Isla.
So if you're not convinced by the scientific progress which will take place, at least if you're a fan of malt whiskey, you should come. So, and with that, I think we wanted to say a special thank you to...
Could I say that Christian and I have been much more visible in the organisation of this conference, because I've been dealing with things like transporting. Christian's been begging you to send abstracts and so on. But Claire has done an awful lot of work in this conference. And, for example, all of the organisation of the food and the conference dinner and the coffees and... a lot of things were done in the background, and I think we'd like to thank her in particular, because Claire has been very well recently, and so we're glad that she's been able to do so much.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Claire, for all of this. than just to wish you all a safe journey.
Yes, sir.